For great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. You're listening to the No Fly Zone with Greg Mabry on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the No Fly Zone. I'm Greg Mabry, your host for the next hour. Little bit of interesting development this week. Apparently, our ABC, as we affectionately call her, or Auntie's in a bit of a tizzy. And you might ask, for those of you who haven't sort of kept up with what's going on, apparently the ratings have tanked in radio, the side of things, in any event. Whether they've tanked in other areas, I'm not quite sure. But there was a report in the West Australian this week where there's a bit of a panic going on at the ABC about a ratings drop. And I've actually posted it on my Facebook page for those people who are on Facebook, and I'll post it on my post-interview report for next week, because it's quite interesting from a number of different perspectives. But the any news that the ratings of any mainstream media outlet tanking is probably very much the dog bites man kind of thing, really, when you think about it. This phenomenon is not peculiar to our esteemed national broadcaster, of course. The decline in patronage of and trust in our establishment media outlets is across the board and hardly limited to Australia. I don't think that's any secret for most of us, really, certainly for those who sort of have an eye for these kinds of things. And the article in the West Australian this week about the ABC, whose brand is very much on the nose, like most of the establishment media brands. This article, of course, being published by another of the very worst offenders in the abuse of public trust, that's the West Australian, or as it's affectionately known over here in Western Australia, as the Worst Australian. The report suggests that the slump in the mainstream media audience and readership metrics is largely due to the bad news fatigue after 3 years of COVID. Fair enough. I guess, you know, not all of us like to be constantly bombarded with bad news. But the way I looked at it was difficult to view this assessment as anything but a self-serving rationale whereby they seek to point to the cause of their own decline in popularity in any direction but their own. Now, might I be so bold as to make a suggestion? Perhaps if the denizens of the mainstream or the establishment media reflected more on things like the veracity, credibility, objectivity, consistency, and the integrity of their overall news output, things might start looking up for them a little bit more. Here's a memo to all you folks out there, our confreres in the mainstream or establishment media sphere. It's not the bad news that's the problem, folks. I hate to be the bearer of this bad news for you, but people can cope with actual bad news. It's your own fake news offerings that renders you irrelevant and redundant. So take that on board, folks. A little bit of free advice there for you, and then you might be able to sort of get back into the ratings game. Now, today, folks, we have with us somebody who I think, in fact, I'm pretty sure would probably appreciate those musings on our media. It's very difficult, as I've often opined, to talk about anything these days, any major issue, without making reference to the way that the establishment media deals with these. Today, our guest is someone, as I said, who might appreciate all of this. Her name's Rebecca Barnett. She's a WA-based writer, activist, and journalist who's making a significant contribution to the resistance against the tyranny of the past 3 years that we've all been experiencing, and also a contribution to our understanding of what's at stake for us all. And amongst many of the issues and concerns that she's that have been raised in the last 3 years, she's taken a special interest in the adverse events, otherwise known as the toxic life-threatening side effects, as I like to actually more accurately describe them, the adverse events of the experimental gene therapies cleverly disguised as vaccines. Rebecca, amongst other things, has quite a few things to say about this, as also and also to the recent unprecedented High Court decision and a few other factors. She writes on Substack under the handle Dystopian Down Under and can be contacted or followed on Twitter. Her Substack URL is rebeccabarnett.substack.com, and her Twitter handle is at dystopian, small d, underscore, capital D-U. Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Rebecca, let's get right into it. We did talk a couple of times this week, and one of the key issues, certainly for you, and one that you've done a lot to bring to the forefront of my mind, is the so-called Australian babies case was recently decided on by the High Court. And this was, in your view, an unprecedented decision by the High Court, not just in your view, but the view of many of the legal experts involved with the case and those who are looking on it. Can you give us a little bit of background to the Australian babies case, what it's all about and how this decision unfolded and what might be the implications going forward?
Sure. So the Australian babies case is a fairly high-profile case that was brought to the High Court by a legal team of Peter Pham from Mart's Method, Katie Ashby-Coppins from PJ O'Brien and Associates, and then Julian Gillespie, a former barrister, was legal consultant also for the applicants on the case. So quite a powerhouse team that had some experience before bringing a COVID vaccine related case to the courts in the federal court. They'd previously brought a case arguing that the approval of, I'm pretty sure it was the Pfizer COVID vaccine for the 5 to 11 age group was unsafe and unlawful. And that case was dismissed from the federal court on the basis of standing, which means that the federal court determined that the applicants on the case did not have standing to bring a case. So when you bring a case to the court, you have to be determined to have standing, which means you have to be determined to have a special interest in the case. Now, the applicants on that case were actually the Australian Vaccine Risks Network. So they've been Australia's peak vaccine choice and awareness body for about 30 years. So that was quite extraordinary that they would be determined to not have standing in a case regarding an experimental vaccine. And the other applicant on that case was the foster father of a child who had actually been essentially mandated by the Department of Child Protection in South Australia to have the vaccine. So again, really surprising to the legal team that these two applicants would be determined to not have standing. So they'd already had that experience where they were quite shocked with the decision of the court. So knowing that, they then prepared a case to the High Court arguing that the approval, this time they went with Moderna's Spikevax for babies and toddlers, 6 months to 5 years, was unsafe and unlawful. Now, they paid special attention in this case to standing because they thought we don't want the same thing to happen again. But standing wasn't an issue on this case. What happened on this case was that it was a fairly complex case because they were arguing both unlawful and unsafe. So they had a lot of expert witnesses and some quite complex scientific evidence. And they were aware that the High Court might say that's all a bit too complicated and that therefore the High Court might want to remit that case down to the federal court. So in anticipation of that concern, they prepared that when the hearing would be had about, so if the High Court were to have that concern, what would typically happen is the High Court would then hold a hearing. It would be discussed. We're not sure if we want to hear this case. It might be too complex. And the legal team was prepared to then cut out anything that was too complex from the case and just argue the simple stuff. But the hearing was never held, and the High Court simply remitted the case down to the federal court, which means that none of the evidence was heard in the High Court. There was no discussion about it with the legal team. It was just decided. And then it's been remitted down to the federal court, and understandably, the legal team position on that is, well, we've seen how the federal court handles these kinds of cases and they don't have confidence. So they've discontinued the case.
What's interesting about this, Rebecca, were the, I mean, it sounds like, you know, they're putting it into the too hard basket, but are they putting it into the too hard legal basket or the too hard medical scientific basket, or is it a bit of both? In other words, did they not feel confident dealing with the medical scientific issues of the case, or is it the legal issues?
So my understanding, from the lawyers, I spoke with the lawyers to write this article. My understanding from them was that the high courts, and I had a look over the decision myself, and my reading of it is that the high court didn't want to hear the technical scientific information. They did specifically say, the quote is something like, it would be taking up an improper use of their time or something like that. I can't find the quote, but something along those lines. But the issue wasn't that they didn't want to deal with that specific evidence. The issue was that they never gave the legal team the opportunity to remove that portion of the case.
And that's where the unprecedented, aspect, because in a case like this, what I'm hearing you say, they would normally put it to a hearing before making a final decision. Is that not the situation here?
That is my understanding. So Peter Pham, one of the lawyers, said that they knew it would be controversial and the High Court might not want to deal with it. So they would have just said, no problem, don't remit the case. We'll just cut the scientifically technical information out and we'll just argue everything but that. Didn't get the option.
One wonders here too, we've talked about the scientific complexities, the scientific and medical complexities, we've talked about legal complexities. Then there's also the political aspects of the case, of course, that maybe the High Court, would it be out of order to suggest that the High Court didn't want to touch it because it was a political, it was a politically explosive issue to go to pursue?
I think what we can say is that had they heard the case, the lawyers were quite confident in the case, and had they heard the case and had it gone in the applicant's favour, that would have opened up a domino effect of cases then occurring in the federal courts over more provisional approvals, you know, for different categories. That would then open up the question of responsibility for injuries and losses sustained. So it would have potentially very serious consequences for the government and also for particular officials. The Secretary of the Department of Health, Brendan Murphy, was on the line in this particular case because he was the one who was specifically identified as not having followed due process in approvals process. So there is a feeling that the High Court was seeking to protect Brendan Murphy and the government, but you know, that's speculation, but I guess it's just worth noting the very high potential costs that would be involved if this case had been heard and then won.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're talking basically a can of worms inside a Pandora's box here, I think, for the government and all the other parties. You know, that's really, I think, what we're dealing. And I don't really think, Rebecca, that it's out of order to speculate or at least have suspicions that this case has not been handled diligently or with great probity. I mean, the fact that the decision itself and the process under which it went to arrive at that decision can now be labelled unprecedented should give us pause for reflecting on how that decision was taken. But of course, it's gone to the High Court. It can't go any further. I mean, as far as I know, legally, it cannot be taken further. Back in the day, I think it used to be that you could take these sorts of cases, and I could be wrong on this, I'm not a legal person. You used to be able to take these cases to the Privy Court in London. I don't know if that actually still applies anymore. I'm not really au fait with that. So it's difficult to say, unless you've got a perspective on it, where do they go to from here? Do we create a whole new case?
I can tell you where they've decided to go. So as I mentioned earlier, they're not going to go forward with the federal court. There's two reasons for that. One is that they don't believe that it will be dealt with fairly because of the federal court's prior decision to dismiss the prior case based on standing. The second reason is that the federal court opens up the prospect of repeated appeals. So really that becomes a game of who's got the most money. And and a recent Fair Work Commission case that I wrote about, actually, that ruled in favour of five unvaccinated Sydney trains drivers kind of showed that there's also the potential then on appeal for the bench to be stacked in favour of the decision that is more politically favourable. So these train drivers, sadly, they won initially, and then on appeal they lost, and the first judge was quite sympathetic, I guess, to the train drivers, and you know, in my estimation, from my understanding, was quite fair. But the second case at the appeal, that was not the case at all.
Okay. So, Rebecca, we have to go to a quick break, so we'll come straight back after that. Hold that thought. You're listening to the No Fly Zone. I'm speaking with Rebecca Barnett here. We'll be back shortly after this break.
You should hear what John Helmer and George Eliason are talking about.
Why is this lot of Pentagon Papers bigger than the Vietnam War Pentagon Papers? The answer really is that the stakes are much greater because the United States and its allies are in direct war with Russia, and they risk losing that war on the Ukrainian battlefield. In Vietnam, the United States lost 58,000 men's lives, American troops' lives, but didn't lose the alliance against so-called China, communist Asia. In Asia, it had next to no effect in Europe, as we can see now. If the United States, however, the United States Army, suffers significant defeat by the Russians of all its major weapon systems, if these are defeated in the Ukraine, then the US is heading for the loss of its empire in Europe and consequently against the Chinese in Asia.
War of the Worlds with John Helmer and George Eliason on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
You're invited to join the pilgrimage to Bath, United Kingdom this June, where we will unveil a better way for health, freedom, and sovereignty. The Better Way Conference is a three-day solutions-based conference with more than 50 expert speakers from around the world. Our Master of Ceremonies, Neil Oliver, will take us on a journey through eight inspiring conversations addressing the issues that matter most to individuals and families around the world right now. Panel hosts include James Corbett of The Corbett Report, Richard Vobes, The Bald Explorer, and the New Americans, Veronica Karolinko, and many more. Wherever you are in the world, you can join us in person or online for less than £40 or $50 for the full program. Get your full conference, single day, or virtual passes now at betterwayconference.org. Please join, share, and collaborate with us as we create a better way for a better world.
To follow us on Twitter, click the link on our site.
You followed me. I feel all warm and fuzzy.
Or search on Twitter.
TNT Radio Live.
TNT Radio.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to the No-Fly Zone. I'm Greg Mabry. I'm speaking today with Rebecca Barnett. Rebecca, amongst other things, writes a Substack page called Dystopian Down Under. And she can also be contacted and followed on Twitter. Her Substack page is Rebecca Barnett, one word, lowercase, .substack.com. And her Twitter handle is @dystopian_DU, @dystopian_DU. Rebecca, we were speaking before the break about the Australian babies case and the court and the High Court's decision on that. What are the implications of this for parents in terms of, you know, them in the future being forced to or in some way coerced to, you know, continue the vaccination programs that have already been in place even before COVID, but any potential new vaccination mandates that come down the pipe? What are the implications for parents and for all of us, I guess?
Oh, that's such a big question. I mean, I should actually just to say, because we did say what is this legal team planning to do next? What they are planning to do next is bring a new case, but I can't speak about what that is. But I do know that on next Monday, there's another case which will be a COVID vaccine injured class action that's going to be filed in the federal court. Now, if these cases continue to get knocked down and dismissed, I guess what it means for parents is you've either got to go off grid and exit the system, or you've got to comply with the system. I suppose what it does is it gives people only one of two black and white options, because if there's no recourse in the courts, then what do? You just completely comply, or you exit the system altogether. That's what I hear parents saying.
Yeah. Based on those feelings and you sort of, you know, having contact with a lot of these people, are they optimistic about, you know, future efforts to, you know, to get some some cases actually ruled in their favour? How optimistic are you? How optimistic are they?
So the Gillespie fam and Ashby Coppins team, they seem optimistic, and they're quite determined. They take every loss and then they learn from it and they pivot and they just keep coming back. They're like the fighter that keeps getting hit and then getting up again.
Yeah.
I know with this other class action, again, that they're fairly confident. I mean, the thing is that... one would think in all of these cases that they would win going forward, because argued on just on fair terms, they are winning cases as far as I can understand. The problem seems to be these surprise, procedurally unfair, strange decisions that don't keep with typical processes and interpretations of the law. That's the issue. So
you're talking technicalities here, are you? You're talking technicalities?
Yeah, and strange interpretations, you know, like the interpretation of standing. I don't think anyone saw that coming on the AVN case, that these applicants could possibly, under any circumstances, be interpreted as not having standing.
Yeah.
So a combination of really strange interpretation that just happens to fall in favor of the more politically expedient solution. So do I have confidence? I don't know. I think that you've got to have a multi-pronged approach, and the courts is one prong. So, you know, if you can get the funding and if the legal practitioners have the will, then I would imagine that there's benefit to keeping on refining one's technique and kind of pivoting and seeing if you can get a win to set a precedent and, you know, cause a cascade of further cases. But I think you'd have to have it. We probably across the board, there need to probably be other prongs in the works as well, if that makes sense.
It does. And I think there are two important things that are needed here. One is not just that that confidence and that optimism. I guess a bit of a glass half full approach to things, but there's also the aspect of funding too. I mean, the opposition have access to, or you know, far greater funds than the people who are fighting the good fight on this one. And I guess too, you know, it's important also too that we all demonstrate a degree of optimism and about, you know, these cases, because to me it seems as if we're going to make any headway here, it will be through the legal system. It's not going to happen through the media. Right. It's not going to happen through the political system or the political process or political discourse. Mm. It's going to happen through the legal system. That's the feedback that I get from a lot of people. And so for that reason alone, I think that's all we can rely on at the moment is what we have legally. Now, we both, I think, sort of would agree, and I think many other people would agree, that the legal system may appear to be compromised at certain levels and at certain points. Mm. But what else do we do? I don't think we really have any other option, Rebecca, but to pursue any and all of these issues through the legal system by the legal means available to us. And here's me dipping my hat to a lot of these legal people, legal experts who are giving of their time to it. And, you know, I have a great deal of admiration for those people who are, you know, putting in the effort and the time to do that. So really, I think that's the avenue which we really need to pursue. The politician's not going to help us. The media's not going to help us. Look, I just want to move on to, you've done quite a bit of work with people who have been vaccine injured. Can we talk a little bit about your work in that respect? I've spoken to a few people on the program about this, and I have a particular interest in it, not necessarily because I've had close friends or family who have been vaccine injured, touching wood, and, you know, and thinking myself pretty lucky that none of my friends who chose to get the vaccination or felt forced to get the vaccination have suffered any of these ill effects. But I certainly know of many anecdotal stories where that's happened. You've actually worked with a lot of these people. Can you give us a bit of an idea of who you work with and what are some of the stories that you've heard about about the adverse events, as they term them?
Sure. I don't remember actually how I got involved, but there's a group called Jab Injuries Global, and I came across the Australian, they're Australian based, guy called Matt started it up, and it's a testimonies project where we just archive the testimonies of injured people. The idea being that they just were not being given a voice and they were not being believed. So things have shifted a little bit in the last couple of months. We've had a few news stories of injured people, and it's now become acceptable for the odd story to be published. But when I started working with Jab Injuries Australia about a year ago, you couldn't get anything published. It was just a taboo subject. So these poor people were just voiceless. So what we do is we interview the injured people. That interview process includes, you know, verifying and, you know, making sure that we've got, you know, the dates and what's your diagnosis and so on and so forth, but also hearing their experience and what that felt like for them. And an interview takes somewhere between 2 to 3 hours, depending on how they're going.
Yeah.
I mean, some of them have to just stop to have a cry halfway through. They're so traumatized. Yeah. And then we put that up on the Instagram page. So I've been doing that for about a year. I would guess that I've interviewed about 30 people, and I've edited another, I don't know how many stories. So I can tell you about some of the themes out of those interviews if you'd like. Unless
yes, please.
Question?
No. Mm. We'll do that. But just before you do, what's that Instagram page link again? Can you repeat that for our listeners, Rebecca?
Sure.
So people who are on Instagram,
it's Jab. Jab_injuries_Australia. So that's for Instagram, and then there's a jabinjuriesglobal.com website.
Okay. Well, they can do a search anyway. So that's Jab Injuries Australia, Jab Injuries Global. Is that right?
Or? Yeah, that's right. So there's actually these Instagram pages for, I don't know, I've lost count of how many countries, but there's one for nearly every country that has the vaccines anyway.
And I did indicate to you, I've had, you know, three or four people on the show previously who have worked with vaccine injured people, and it's something that I am going to pursue every now and again to the extent that I can with just 1 hour, with one weekly hour show, because we, if for only one other reason or for one simple reason, that these injuries are going to be ongoing and we're going to see a huge increase in these injuries down the track, as long as these semi-forced or coerced vaccinations continue. You know, we haven't seen the end of it by any stretch of the imagination at this stage. So it's certainly something that we will pursue. But continue on. Give us a few ideas of some of the people that you've spoken to, Rebecca. I'd like to hear some of the personal stories, obviously without mentioning people's names, of course. But
Although most of them do identify themselves on Jab Injuries Australia, I have done some anonymous ones, including a 10-year-old child, which just broke my heart. I did the interview with the mother, and you can just imagine what those parents have to go through, because they have the guilt of having trusted the doctor, trusted the government, you know, taken their child in, and essentially now having to carry the guilt of having facilitated the catastrophic injury to their children. It's really not fair. But so I had one case of a little 10-year-old boy who was just so ill for a year. The interview that I did was a year post the injection. Just not able to function, couldn't exercise, the personality change, kind of just bedridden or just lying on the couch, you know, all the neurological stuff. Ended up spending weeks in hospital. The thing that I find interesting, well, the common thread that I find with all of them is it's very rare to get an injured person who goes to the doctor, says, I had my jab and now I'm sick with all these weird symptoms, and the doctor will consider that the vaccine might have been related. Most of them, if they mention that they've just been vaccinated and now I'm experiencing all these symptoms, most of them get shut down straight away and told, oh, that's a conspiracy, you know, which is quite surprising. And a lot of them will just get told they're anxious. That happened a lot at emergencies. I don't know if it's still happening, but almost all of my interviews, when they present at emergency, and these are people who are later diagnosed with pericarditis, myocarditis, really serious neurological conditions, most of them initially get told that they're anxious, that they're overreacting, and to just go home and chill out. Many of them also then, when they subsequently go to doctors saying, I've still got all these complaints, many of them then get prescribed antidepressants and told, you know, you need to just go on these and improve your mood. And I had one young girl, Katie. She was working in the army. She got the vaccine to keep her job, obviously. It gave her myocarditis. But before she actually sadly was discharged for being unfit for duty because of the myocarditis that she got from the vaccine. But before she got the diagnosis, she was gaslit constantly by medical professionals and told that she, you know, was anxious, told that she was depressed. I think she was prescribed antidepressants once or twice, and then she was ordered not to exercise. And then when she went to another health professional down the line, he told her that she'd gained weight and really she should exercise more because that's why she was sick. And, you know, I guess he just hadn't bothered to read her chart, or, you know, hadn't bothered to read that she was physically unable to exercise. And this is, by the way, myocarditis, the condition that the TGA assures everyone is mild and self-resolving and, you know, doesn't really affect people's quality of life. And here we have a 25-year-old unable to really walk upstairs or exercise, and is being discharged from her, you know, career, like her ambition, life ambition career, because of the myocarditis that she got from the jab that she got to keep her job.
Yeah, I mean, it's I'm at a loss with words when I hear these stories. I really am, and again, I'm thankful that you know, nobody that I know and hold dear who has had the jab has thus far succumbed to any of these kinds of injuries. But that doesn't stop me from empathizing with these stories that are removed from my own life, and I just, because I understand the scope and the sweep of this program and what it's doing to people, and coupled with that, of course, is a degree of incomprehension on my part as to how and why the medical profession and the media and the politicians just are sweeping it all under the carpet, even now, well, after all of this time.
I think some of it is lack of education and knowledge. I've had injured people tell me about nurses and doctors Googling side effects.
Yeah.
Like Googling it to figure out if the thing that the person is saying they're experiencing could be related to the vaccine. Like, how do they not know this? But the answer is, well, because it wasn't researched adequately before it was rolled out.
Exactly.
So, you know, that's one explanation.
And of course, you know, I mean, all of those side effects, you know, they're well publicized now after Pfizer tried to hide, of course, these side effects that they discovered in their so-called trials, quote unquote. And you know, people are aware of them now. But what's interesting here is I found too, anecdotal evidence points to me that even people who are affected badly by the vaccines, a lot of people simply don't want to acknowledge that they've actually been affected by the vaccines.
Well, you know, and a doctor explained to me just a couple of days ago, actually, that there is a incentive to diagnose if there's been a vaccination and a COVID infection. Doctors are disincentivized to pursue the vaccine avenue, and they're incentivized to pursue the long COVID avenue. There's plenty of funding for long COVID. It's politically accepted to talk about it, to diagnose it. Everyone's very empathetic towards that. Well, this is the doctor's point of view. The vaccines, not so much. You know, ARPRA will investigate you if you write too many exemptions. Doctors were getting you know, harassed, reported for suggesting that the vaccines might be causing some injuries. So it's apparently very time consuming to lodge a report. So even though they are required by law to report a vaccine injury, there is a baked in disincentive to consider it as an option. Whereas it's much, and not also he sent me a few pages from a professional digest that he gets, and that almost there was a double spread on long COVID. They're not getting double spreads on vaccine injuries in these professional kind of communiques.
Rebecca, we have to go to a break. I want to talk about long COVID after we come back. You're listening to the No Fly Zone with Greg Mabry. I'm speaking with Rebecca Barnett. We'll be back shortly after this break.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
It's official. Democrats hate women. On a party-line vote, Republicans in the House of Representatives today passed the Protection of Women and Girls in Sports Act, 219 to 203 votes. Not a single Democrat voted in favor of protecting women and girls from having to compete with biological men. And should the measure pass the Senate, President Biden mumbled something to the effect that he has been instructed to veto this bill. Why does this matter? Because biology trumps ideology, even woke ideology. When Jackie Joyner Kersee, the fastest woman in Olympic history, won the gold medal in the 100 meters, 300 high school boys beat her time that year. And it's instructive to note that men's sports haven't been infiltrated by quote-unquote trans men. Why? Because that would simply highlight the fact that biology trumps ideology. Women simply cannot compete with men on an equal basis. So we're either going to have women's sports or we aren't. And right now, it looks like only Republicans want women's sports to continue. For MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
This is 5.5 liters of liquid. Now, if you remove a pint, here it is again. Did you notice the difference? Of course not. There's 5.5 liters of blood in the human body. By donating a pint, you'll save up to 3 lives. Give what you can go without to those who can't live without. To start saving lives today, Google your nearest donor center.
This is the No Fly Zone with Greg Maybury on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to the program. I'm speaking with Rebecca Barnett today. Rebecca, before the break, we were talking, we touched on long COVID. Can you give us a bit of an idea? First of all, what is long COVID? Give us an explanation of what is long COVID. How did this whole concept of long COVID come about? What does it mean going forward for those people particularly who have suffered adverse events from the vaccines? What does it mean for their short term? What does it mean for their long term future?
Goodness me, where do I start? Okay, well, let's start with what is it? I'm writing an article on this at the moment. So I'll tell you the WHO definition. That's probably a good place to start. The continuation or development of new symptoms 3 months after the initial COVID infection, with these symptoms lasting for at least 2 months with no other explanation. So very, very, very broad. Basically, I had COVID and I feel a bit off 3 months later, really, you know? Okay. So that includes 200 different symptoms. So it's an extraordinarily broad definition. Notably, a completely different kind of bar for proof or diagnosis to what would be required for a long vaccine determination. Like if we were to substitute there the continuation or development of new symptoms several months after the initial injection, I think we would have an awful lot of vaccine injured people in Australia, but we don't seem to apply the same standards to these things. So, yeah, so that's the World Health Organization definition. Then there's the question of, well, what causes it and what characterizes it? Well, the symptoms that seem to be most prevalent are fatigue, shortness of breath, cognitive dysfunction, depression, headaches, and so on. Interestingly, it was noted in the long COVID inquiry submissions by numerous submissions, including Coverse, which is Australia's number one vaccine injury support network, and also Karen Phelps noted it in her submission, that there is a lot of crossover between long COVID and long vaccine. People seem to have very similar symptoms. So that leads us to one of the theories about what causes it, which is one of the theories is that it's spike related. Another
spike protein
theory,
related.
Someone like Dr. Peter McCullough, who's I'm sure your listeners know who he is, cardiologist and COVID expert from the States. You know, he says, based on this theory that you want to ultimately limit exposure to the spike. So you can't necessarily control how many infections you're going to get in a lifetime because it's a circulating respiratory virus. People are going to get it. But you can control whether you inject it into your body or not. He uses that as one of his reasons for not injecting on a regular basis. And there's other theories about it's caused by a kind of like an immune reaction to the virus. And then, of course, we've got studies that are showing no relationship to prior infection. A recent one showed that it was long COVID symptoms, self-reported, I think, long COVID symptoms were related rather to loneliness and lack of physical movement. And in fact, COVID infection was one of the most unrelated factors from a massive list of factors. I've also seen a recent study showing that mask wearing for prolonged periods of time produces symptoms similar to long COVID symptoms. And therefore those authors suggested that it's possible that some of what we're calling long COVID is actually long mask. Also there's one other study that's worth mentioning, which is a study that I actually posted about on my Substack a couple of weeks ago, I think, which found that people, now this was about vaccination, people with attitudes, people who expected worse outcomes from their vaccination, as in they either didn't think it would work very well or they were afraid of side effects, those people were more likely to experience more severe side effects than people who went in with positive attitudes. So,
okay,
you know, one might then extrapolate from that and say, well, if you are expecting to get long COVID, if you are scared of getting infected, you know, does that have an effect on how you experience post-infection? I don't know the answer to that. You'd have to research it. But the point is, a lot is not known.
Just on that one, of course, has to question, you know, who funds these studies and, you know, who's behind them and all those sorts of things. But of course, that's a discussion for another time. We actually talked about that before our interview today. We talked about the mind-body connection. I think that was something that you had just alluded to then, is it not?
I mean, the study doesn't get into the mechanics of it, but the mind-body connection is something I've got personal experience with, which I did mention to you, where I probably learned about that through my own journey. Different to saying it's all in your head, rather looking at the relationship between beliefs and expectations and how that can actually kind of hand in glove produce symptoms in one's own body. And I've looked into that a lot on my own personal journey, because I have fibromyalgia, which is you know, it's one of those strange amorphous, like, you've got pain and we don't know why, and, you know, stress seems to affect it and emotional state seems to affect it. So that sent me on my own path.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, because I brought up the word today earlier before our discussion, the word psychosomatic, and you're quite right in sort of correcting me on that. Psychosomatic is something that probably has a pejorative tone in the sense that it's all in your head sort of thing, whereas the mind-body connection, I totally believe myself, you know, I have no problems believing that, you know, you end up sort of becoming affected by your emotional, mental and psychological moods and phases and all of these sorts of things. So, you know, this whole thing about keeping a positive mind and, you know, all of this sort of thing, I think is very, very important. It's something that we don't talk about enough. There probably hasn't been enough research done into it. But linking it with go on.
Well, if I might say, I think fear is an emotion that has a really strong the ability to create strong physical symptoms in the body. So I spent a year personally working with this app called Curable, which aims to help sufferers of chronic pain to not be so afraid of their own symptoms, because first you get the pain, then you get the fear of, oh my goodness, I'm getting another episode, and when will it end? And oh my goodness, am I going to, do I have to cancel everything for the next 3 weeks or whatever? And so this, I spent quite a lot of time working on reframing how I view pain and how I react to it. Now, I still experience chronic pain, but it's quite incredible how just eliminating the fear and the panic from the symptoms, from my reaction to the symptoms rather, has actually made it a much more manageable condition for me. I don't And I find the pain then doesn't escalate to that point of being, you know, driven, demented by pain. It's much more manageable. So when we had all this fear mongering over the virus, my ears pricked up because I thought, whoa, I've personally experienced how fear can really drive physical symptoms in the body and, you know, how important it is to just keep quite calm about it and, you know, how your beliefs about what something's going to do to you can actually kind of co-create that as a reality in your own body.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, fear creates anxiety, and anxiety is one of the mm-hmm. most distressing things anybody can experience. I've had one or two episodes in my own life, and I do not want to ever go through them again. And I think a lot of anxiety, not just individual anxiety that people experience and have certainly experienced in the last 3 years, but the collective anxiety has been as a direct result of all of the fear-mongering that we've seen by our politicians, by our media, by our medical profession, by all those people who've got a vested interest in keep pushing this fear surrounding the whole COVID thing, you know, get your vax and, you know, everything will be hunky-dory. And, of course, it's not. And I just think collectively that has had an extraordinary impact on our society, even on kids, you know, who don't fully understand what's going on. I sort of wonder just what's going through the minds of young kids today, whether they're vaccinated or not, or whether their parents are vaccinated or not. Just all of the fear-mongering because they can't escape it. It happens in their school environment. It happens when they're talking with their mates and all that sort of thing. So I'm quite sure, you know, that all of this kind of fear-mongering has had an enormously negative impact on, you know, who we are. And how all of these events have unfolded. We talk about the adverse events that are listed on Pfizer's documents, but this is one of the adverse events of this whole episode of the last 3 years that I think has possibly had one of the biggest and maybe perhaps the longest term impacts. I guess we'll never know. There'll probably never be an inquiry into it, but the psychological impact of the whole fear-mongering in the last 3 years is certainly of great concern. I guess really getting back to long COVID, what concerns me here is that it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that long COVID has kind of been invented to give the powers that be some sort of an out. Rebecca, do you see that? Mm-hmm. Is long COVID real? I mean,
I can see why people argue that. My understanding is that long viral syndromes have always existed, but they're just not at the rates that that we're saying that long COVID exists. So, what I can say is I remember I was taking all these jab injury interviews. I was just coming across more and more people who were injured, and people would start saying, when it all comes out, you know, then people will have to believe, like once their friends start getting sick or someone in their family gets sick. And I remember saying at the time, I felt that was quite naive. And I felt like, no, they'll call it long COVID. I don't know. I don't know if it was invented for that purpose, but I do think that it will be taken advantage of. You know, I think it's very easy to just say, oh, it's long COVID, it's long COVID. There's no risk. There's no political risk in calling something long COVID like there is in calling it a vaccine injury.
I think we're talking here a get out of jail free card, basically.
Exactly.
That's how I view it, you know. And you know, I again, like you, I just sort of wonder until and unless a critical mass of people do start to actually look at what's happening, not just within their own families, And I think that's really where people are going to make the connection, is when it starts to impact on their own families, and particularly people who are parents, if and when it starts to impact on, you know, their own children. You mentioned that 10-year-old boy earlier on, and I'm sure he's, you know, probably only one example of many young people who've been affected by this. Until and unless people actually wake up to this and find out that there is something really seriously wrong here. Vaccines have been pulled from the market many times before, with far less side effects appearing and showing up. And yet 3 years, we're still pursuing this. So this is really quite a unique case, and it certainly has not played itself out by any means at this point. We're still going to be talking about this for years to come, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. Rebecca, we only have about a minute to go. Just a couple of quick points you might like to make. I'm just going to reiterate firstly, though, today we're speaking with Rebecca Barnett, listeners. You can contact Rebecca on Rebecca Barnett on Substack, and you can also connect with her on Twitter at dystopian_DU. That's at dystopian. You can also check out on Instagram the Jab Injuries Australia and Jab Injuries Global. Jab Injuries on Instagram, just look under that and you'll find there many reports from Rebecca. Rebecca, we're going to finish up now, and thank you for your time. I really appreciated speaking with you, and we'll look forward to seeing what you come up with on Substack. You've got a couple of things on the boil at the moment, and we'll have you back on the program soon. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you.